Blog Talk Radio. Okay, so I want you to listen to this quote.
But I really didn't know if anyone would read it and like it. Wherever it's gone and it's been translated, it's getting translated into several other languages as well. People do seem to recognize something of themselves. Somehow I put that in there without, I'm very happy I did.
That's Irish author Colin Barrett talking about his debut short story collection, Young Skins, which won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, the Guardian First Book Award, the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature, and has critics and readers alike wanting to know all about this extremely talented and extremely likable writer. Colin is one of three fiction writers featured on this episode of the Literary New England Radio Show, where I'll also talk with Jonathan O'Dell about Miss Hazel and the Rosa Parks League, which focuses on two young mothers, one wealthy and white, the other poor and black, and the unexpected friendship that forms between them.
We need to know these stories. The book is written about the 1950s, pre-civil rights, and the truths are being forgotten. It was the women, the black women, who started this movement, not white men, not white kids from the North saving black folks. It was the women, the maids, the share workers, the sharecroppers, the illiterate people sometimes who stood out. That's the history.
I'm your host, Cindy Wolf Boynton, and I'll also talk with Susan Wilson, author of The Dog Who Saved Me. It was her agent, she said, who suggested that maybe she revolve her storylines around man's best friend, because really, who doesn't love a dog story?
When I was a child, I only read stories that had to do with animals. And I would go into my school library and I would pick out every animal-centered book. And I read them, devoured them, and it's such a natural fit. This is something I'm passionate about and I know quite about a bit about, and what fun it would be to do that.
We'll give away copies of all three of the books featured tonight, starting with The Dog Who Saved Me. Win one by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Susan is the author of 9 novels, the last 4 of which have dog, not just as part of the title, but a dog as a major part of the storyline. Human to a terrier named Bonnie, Susan lives on Martha's Vineyard, and I'll let her tell you what this new book is all about.
Well, The Dog Who Saved Me is essentially the story of a man named Cooper Harrison, who has left his family home in a small town called Harmony Farms, and he's left at the age of 18. He has turned his back on his rather awful family and has achieved some success as a member of the Boston Police Force, specifically as a canine dog handler. When we meet him, his life has spiraled out of control due to the rather tragic demise of his beloved partner, canine partner Argos. And what has happened is essentially he is suffering from depression and PTSD, and that has cost him everything that he's achieved, including his job. He's given up because he can't face it. His wife has had enough of his problem and has left him. And when we meet him, he has been offered a job back in his hometown by his former basketball teammate, who is now the chief of police. But the job is not as a police officer, but as an animal control officer. And Cooper has, he's 3 times he said, no, I'm not back. I'm not going to do that. That's terrible. And he's wallowing in his grief. And finally, push does come to shove, and he agrees to take the job for a year. And so our prodigal son returns home to Harmony Farms. And his mandate to himself is that he will have nothing to do with his town drunk father and his recently released convict brother. So that's where we meet him, and during the course of the early part of the story, it becomes obvious that there is a feral dog who has suffered his own trauma, and we do actually see part of the story through the dog's eyes, which is what I do with my dog stories. And this is a yellow dog who has been traumatized, brutalized, and has lost all of his ability to trust human beings. And so we have kind of a parallel of the dog who cannot trust and the man who cannot trust. And, of course, they have to be brought together, and that is the story.
I'm guessing that you're a dog person.
I am. My faithful hound is right here next to me, so sunning herself.
And what's her name?
Her name is Bonnie. She's actually a terrier cross. We don't know with what. She looks like a giant Jack Russell or a miniature wolfhound. We can't decide which, but she's been my constant companion for over 12 years. So.
Oh my goodness.
Yep.
Oh my, and is she a rescue dog?
She is, but I always have to qualify that because she was born in a shelter. She was one of those dogs that is born in a southern shelter and then they immediately ship them north and they're adopted out. So I always like to say that she was a rescue, but she didn't know it and she never suffered, and her life has been really quite good. So
as it should be, as all of our lives should be, man or beast.
Exactly. She's got it pretty darn good.
So The Dog Who Saved Me isn't your first novel that's had a canine as a key character. Tell me about this decision to incorporate dogs into your stories.
Well, let me just say that this is actually my fourth. Back in, 2010 it must have been. I published a book called One Good Dog, and that is the book that sort of launched me on my way to using the canine-human relationship as a trigger or a metaphor for the story. I mean, that's what I've been doing. And that got started because I had been struggling with another novel. I mean, The Dog Who Saved Me is actually my ninth novel. And I've been struggling with another one, and my agent and I had been working on it for quite a long time. I'm talking, you know, several years, and I kind of hit sort of a trough. And I said to her, you know what, Andrew, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I need to do something else. And apropos of absolutely nothing, she says, you know, dog stories are really popular. Now, this is just about the time we were having this conversation when The Art of Racing in the Ring came out. And
oh, my goodness, great book.
Your Sawtelle story came out. And I said, oh, really? And I started to laugh, and I said, you know, when I was a child, I only read stories that had to do with animals. And I would go into my school library, and I would pick out every animal-centered book, and I read them, devoured them. I was a huge fan of Albert Payson Terhune's Collies, such that I had collies growing up. I laughed because I said, why didn't I think of that? Because, you know, it's such a natural fit. This is something I'm passionate about, and I know quite a bit about, and what fun it would be to do that. And that's what got me kicked, you know, into this gear. And One Good Dog actually was structured quite a bit different from the other ones in that the dog, Chance, has a point of view and actually speaks to the reader. And I've never done that since because I think you can only do that maybe once, although I'm working on sort of a sequel of that. But still, it launched the idea of using the dogs and having dogs an integral part of the story.
Sure. So you have One Good Dog, The Dog Who Danced, A Man of His Own, and The Dog Who Saved Me. And I think that's pretty terrific.
It is. It's actually in my contract now.
Really? So you've become like the dog writer?
The dog writer, yes. In fact, I am a member of that organization, the Dog Writers Association of America, which is kind of a...
Get out of here.
I'm serious. It's a huge organization, but it's people who not only are novelists, or most aren't, but are bloggers and magazine writers and professional dog handlers and people like that, how-tos and do-nots and all that sort of thing. So that's kind of a cool group to hang out with.
Oh my! I can't believe that a group exists like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's awesome, but holy crow!
you know, there's a group for everything, and like I said, it's extensive. They do a huge banquet in New York during the Westminster Kennel Club, which I missed this year because of the weather. So,
well, I remember. So I used to be the editor of a health magazine, mm-hmm. and when we had a lead article on the health benefits of having pets,
mm-hmm.
and on our cover was a photograph of a gentleman, you know, playing with his dog. The dog was licking his face. And I'll tell you, we probably sold twice as many magazines that issue as any other issue before.
I can believe it. It speaks to the human condition. It really does. And I think particularly now in the last, I'm going to, you know, stretch it out here and say 10 to 15 years, when I think there is an acknowledgement of the fact that having pets, and I'm not just going to say dogs, but, you know, cats, gerbils, whatever, there is a benefit. There is definitely a benefit. And, I mean, I've seen it myself. I mean, we have this, well, let's face it, she was our empty nest substitute, and we spend a lot of time walking and, you know, all that sort of thing. So, and it's good. Brings the blood pressure down.
Sure. So not that I want to generate competition for you, but how come we don't have more books like yours out there?
Well, I think there are. I'm certainly not alone in this genre, if I can use that term. But different people do it in different ways. Now we've got
sure.
The Burton Chet series, which, and I'm blanking completely on the author's name, and I shouldn't because he's local. but you know, whose dog tells a story of whatever mystery the owner is conducting. But you know, and it's hilarious. They're really funny. Certainly Enzo was the sine qua non of dog narrators.
Yes.
And Gar Stein's masterwork. And, you know, so they're definitely out there.
So is there something that you hope that your readers are going to experience in The Dog Who Saved Me?
Well, I think the chief thing is when somebody finishes a book, I want them to say, wow, I really like that book. I really enjoyed the characters. I really believed that they exist. I think that's every writer's goal is to create a, I mean, let's face it, it's an imaginary world, but if you're doing your job, when the reader finishes, they feel like they've met people and they've been in their company. And I think that's my chief goal. It's entertainment. I mean, it's the entertainment industry in a lot of ways. If my story does not either make you cry or make you laugh, I haven't done my job.
And the storyline in The Dog Who Saved Me, I think, is so very realistic. Did you base it off anything that actually happened?
I can't say that for sure, but I think that, as with any writer, everything that comes to you filters through, goes to the grist mill, and it comes out. And, I mean, certainly there are people in this world who come from really awful backgrounds, who rise above those backgrounds, and then are forced to confront that background. And that's exactly what happens to Cooper. He's forced to confront his own anger at his family and his own alienation from them, and in so doing, going back to his small town. And I always write small towns, I mean, almost always, because I live in one. He discovers something about himself. He discovers that he actually is, you know, he's not judged necessarily by his antecedents. He is judged on himself. And I think that becomes his learning curve.
So you mentioned that you live in a small town. You actually live in my favorite place on earth. You live in Martha's Vineyard.
Yes, I do.
Have you lived your whole writing life on Martha's Vineyard, and has it inspired your work?
Well, it's interesting you term it as writing life. I love that you would ask it in that way, because the answer is absolutely, absolutely. We've lived here, gosh, you know, 26, 27 years. My husband grew up here. I was a summer kid. I had the good sense to marry an islander, but we lived, as we like to call it, away for 17 years before we came back and settled and raised the kids here. And while we were living away, I was, you know, I worked for Unirail Chemical, I worked at a bank, I, you know, had two babies, and I always wanted to write but did not. I'll qualify that a little bit. Of course, I was writing, but it was not openly, shall we say. It was something that I did, really under the radar. I never spoke about it because the environment we were living in, we had dear, dear friends, but they were not, that was not what they did. They were not artists or writers. I mean, they're wonderful salt of the earth people. When we moved to Martha's Vineyard, everybody and his uncle is a writer, a singer, a dancer, an artist, a sculptor. You name it, everybody's got something that they do. And it's so so broadening. And here I am, you know, this little mom with their two kids, and when we moved here, I bought myself a computer. And this is so long ago, it didn't have a hard drive. It only had... You remember those? It
was like those big floppy disks.
Yes, and I'd have to load it in every time, and then God forbid, I forgot to save. And I'm starting to peck out these little stories, and somehow, one of the other moms in the play group said, "Mom's starting a writers group," and I'm like, "A writers group? You're kidding me!" And we gathered, several of us, and we did very little discussion about writing. We mostly talked about our kids, but it was still the idea that people talked about their passion. It was amazing. So it really did. It gave me permission to actually do what I wanted to do, and I sat down and pumped out a few things and got lucky along the way, and because I knew somebody here who knew an agent who liked the work, and that's kind of how it works. But anyway, my writing life has been all here. It's been marvelous.
Susan, I love that story. That's fabulous. And you know what? Someone can help by making sure that someone in the know sees your first book. But you know what? If that book isn't any good and then the one that follows it isn't any good, then you're all done.
Yes. Or you have to start over and figure out what's going wrong. And I've been extremely blessed in that my agent has stuck with me all these years through the good times and the bad. And like I say, when I first struck on the idea of the canine storytelling, I was in a slump. I mean, it had been 4 years since I'd had anything published, and she stuck with me, and she kept saying, "No, I know this. You can do it. You can do it." And that kind of support is indescribably invaluable. It really is. I mean, if your agent says, "You know, I think maybe you ought to go get a job," well, then you say, "Well, I guess maybe I better stop." But again, this environment is so conducive to it. In fact, it's pervasive throughout the entire culture here. On next Thursday, I think it is, there'll probably be 20 or 25 writers who are going to the high school and are going to do a workshop with kids. And, you know, it's extraordinary and very supportive. Writers are very supportive of each other here. And we have people who are, you know, Geraldine Brooks and Tony Horowitz, and we have me, and we have, you know, self-published and, you know, the gamut. But everybody's
sure.
Very polite and very supportive, and, you know, we cheer each other on.
As it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And now, Susan, I know you have a website. Is that the best place for people to go and learn about you and your books?
That in the Facebook page, which I confess I spend a little bit more time on because it's easier. And that would be just Susan Wilson Author, I think, is how you can find it.
And your website is SusanWilsonWrite.
.com.
And do you enjoy hearing from readers?
I love it. I mean, I really feel like, even the ones that call, you know, who will write and say, I had to stop reading your book because you used a bad word. I get these. And, I mean, I just feel like, you know, you write in a vacuum, let's face it. I mean, you do it in your house by yourself, and you send it out, and you don't see the faces. And so for people to contact me, and they do through the website, there's an email, contact Susan thing, and it comes right to my email, it's great. I get some wonderful conversations going, and, you know, it's very gratifying, and it, you know, keeps you inspired. Like, somebody out there really is liking this, I guess I better keep going, so...
Fun. And can you tell us what you're working on now, or is it a secret?
It's not a secret. What I'm working on now, interestingly, is it's not a sequel, but it has it shares characters with the one good dog, with the novel One Good Dog. And part of that is my editor, who is also equally fabulous. No, it wasn't my editor. I take that back. It was my agent said, you know, I mean, everybody loved that book so much. Is there any chance we could get these characters back? And at first I balked, and I thought, hey, you know, once I'm done with somebody, I'm done. But, you know, Chance was a very powerful little character, and his person, Adam, was a very interesting character in his own right. And I thought, well, yeah, why not? Now, they're only playing cameo roles in this. They're not the main story by any means. The main story is of a I'll get to practice how to decide how the story goes. A woman who is a single mom who has bought a rundown hotel in the Berkshires and is struggling with a very sullen and really upset daughter who is upset for reasons that are part of the still working on. And Adam becomes a guest there with his dog. And there's another dog involved, and then it goes on from there. So it's still very nascent, but that's kind of a very thin plot right now.
Fun. That sounds wonderful. Susan, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, my pleasure entirely. I'm so happy to do it, and I'm happy to do any time.
If you follow Literary New England on Facebook or Twitter, or regularly read our blog, which is at litnewengland.tumblr.com, you might have had some scary good fun taking part in our 5-day Witch-a-thon, which we hosted from April 1st to 5th. During that time, we gave away books like M.J. Rose's The Witch of Painted Sorrows and Paula Braxton's The Silver Witch. We tweeted witch book quotes and posted articles and images related to New England witch trial books like Catherine Howe's Conversion, Elizabeth George Spear's The Witch of Blackbird Pond, and Connecticut Witch Trials, First Panic in the New World. If you missed it, the good news is that all the posts are accessible on our Tumblr page. And if you use the hashtag Witchathon, no hyphens, just one word, Witchathon on Twitter, all kinds of tweets will pop up. Even though the Witchathon is officially over, I have a few more witch-related posts to share over the next couple of days, as well as at least one more witch book to give away. So be sure to follow us on Twitter or on Facebook or on Tumblr or on all three, so you don't miss anything going on. So many great books to give away to you there through social media as well as tonight on the show. In fact, I'm holding a copy of Colin Barrett's Young Skins in my hand right now that I'd love for you to have. Win it by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to litnewengland@gmail.com, as Colin and I talk about his short story collection and the time he spent visiting colleges and bookstores in the U.S. He was just here supporting Young Skins, making stops all over the place, including those in New England and elsewhere on the East Coast. And I was curious whether he had ever been to this part of the U.S. before.
I'd been to New York before, and when I was very young, I believe I was in Boston. That may be a counterfeit memory. But I hadn't been in other parts, like in New England before, or in Philadelphia. I also visited Hartford in Connecticut, which was a first time as well. So most of the tour was new to me, and places I hadn't been before.
Oh, that's right. You went to Trinity College in Hartford.
Trinity in Hartford, yeah. Rutgers out in New Jersey. So there was lots of little stops and stuff along the way. The main three cities, I suppose, I visited were Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. But as I said, yeah, there was a lot of little stops along the way, saying hi to people. And so I met every type of person. I met, like, you know, regular readers, a lot of creative writing students and aspiring writers. So it was a nice mix.
Nice, nice. And how do you like this part of the world?
It's lovely, yeah. There was snow everywhere when I got into Boston, which was hadn't really dressed for. But apart from that, it became more temperate as we progressed on the tour. And it's a beautiful time of year, and everyone's been very nice to me, so and curiously interested in my book, which is a very pleasant surprise.
Well, of course, and before we talk about your book, you've now sparked a question that's going to show my lack of knowledge about world geography, but does it snow in Ireland?
It does snow, not that much, and it's usually snow that lacks. It's certainly not like the snow here. It doesn't stick around on the ground, you know, usually. It's a kind of, it's a snow that lacks the intensity that you get here. So it does happen, but not that often, unfortunately. Mostly rain. You're never too far away from a rainy day in Ireland. That's your usual climate.
Well, I think right now most of us would take a rainy day over an intensely snowy day any day of the year.
Yeah, it's certainly milder in Ireland. It is rainy, but when it's sunny, it's beautiful, of course. And even when it's rainy, it's still often very pretty. But you certainly don't get the extremes you get here. So that took some getting used to. I think I had to wear all the clothes I brought the first day in Boston.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. But you have, we're here to talk about your book, and you have written this wonderful book called Young Skins, which is a collection of stories, which has just received all kinds of awards, has been so well-reviewed, really around the world. Everybody seems to be talking about this book. Please, tell us about the collection and what we see in it.
Okay, well, it is a collection of short stories, six kind of conventionally long short stories, and then one longer piece, which is a novella, so it is almost a novel-length story. They're all set in the fictional west of Ireland coastal town called Glambay. And it's really, I mean, each story then is just about a different kind of group of characters in that town. It's set more or less in contemporary Ireland or near contemporary Ireland. It's a marginal kind of economically depressed town. So a lot of the people are just trying to get by. I focus mainly on the younger characters, some of whom are alienated from their immediate circumstances, some of whom are trying their best to get along. Each story just kind of details their activities and adventures, which are usually ill-advised and ill-conceived, but hopefully entertaining for the reader to sort of follow and engaging.
So what do you think people get out of reading this book? What's the takeaway from Young Skins?
That's a very good question, Cindy. I mean, I've been bowled over by the just continuing interest. It's gotten everywhere. It's come out in, and it was first published by a very small publisher in Ireland, and I really didn't think it would have any sort of interest beyond my domestic sort of my country where people would be familiar with the material. But in the UK and here in the US, I mean, it does resonate with people, and it has, whether people are from small towns or not, they do seem to understand that I capture something of the dynamics of living in a community now as a young person, and the sort of estrangements and difficulties you may find, and also the consolations and sort of happier moments. But, that wasn't anything, that all sounds very ambitious on my part or something, as if I'd planned all this when I wrote it, but I really didn't know if, you know, anyone would read it and like it. So the fact that wherever it's gone and it's been translated, it's getting translated into several other languages as well, that, you know, people do seem to recognize something of themselves in the story. I think it's that simple, and somehow I put that in there without, I'm very happy I did.
So you haven't always been a writer, or at least you haven't been a writer who has been published before. You've done other things as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how this book came to be and who exactly you are professionally?
Sure. Well, I'm a full-time writer now, at the moment, for however long that lasts. Writing's usually a pretty precarious profession. So I'm very lucky in that instance that the book has done well enough that, you know, I can continue to work full-time on the next one. But yeah, like a lot of other writers, I spent years, you know, having to do other things. I graduated college I did English in UCD in University College Dublin. That was over 12 years ago, and I worked for about 5 years after that full time in an office job, for a phone company in Ireland. And that was, you know, that was a great job, but it was, you know, it was just a regular 9-to-5 thing. And I always had ambitions to write, and I wrote sort of in the evening that weekend. And then about in 2008, 2009, I went and did a creative writing master's in UCD again, and kind of gave up the job and took the plunge, made the decision, however wiser, not to to try and write full time. And it still took. I mean, this book came out in 2013, so there was nearly 4 years after I finished that course of just working on the material. And not every story you write is going to work out, you know. So I was still kind of honing my abilities and sort of finding the right voice. And that's, you know, so it was kind of, I was writing for well over, I mean, I considered I was writing for, I wanted to be a writer for maybe 10 years before the book got published.
And now people are saying that you are a singular new voice in contemporary fiction. That's a big label.
It is, yeah. The things that have been said about it are so nice. You know, I read them, and it's invariably by writers I, you know, massively, I'm huge fans of and totally in awe of, whether that's Sam Enright or Sam Lipside or someone like that, Colin McCann. Yeah, they say very nice things, and it makes me want to read the book, and then I realize I actually wrote it. So I mean, that's, you know, that's good. I hope the contents live up to the various compliments it's been paid.
But what do you think, though, when you look at the book? I mean, I've written books myself before, never certainly that I've gotten anywhere near the recognition you have gotten. But sometimes I do open up one of my books and I read a page and, well, I either cringe, I look at it and cringe, or I look at it and I say, wow, you know, that's pretty darn good. Where did that come from? You know, do you ever have those kinds of experiences looking at your own work?
Now and then, yeah, it is a kind of a weird thing. Once the book gets published and put out there, you do kind of, you know, you lose it in a sense, in one way, you know, and you become a little bit, it becomes its own thing, and yeah, you kind of no longer feel like you've a total claim over it anymore. And what that means is when you open it up months later or whatever, yeah, you can. Usually, I like you and like every other writer, I see the defects and the flaws straight away, and I was like, oh God, I wish I could have changed that sentence or whatever. But then at other times, you can very rarely, yeah, you can kind of read something and be like, okay, yeah, that's good. That's what I was trying to do. I'm glad I achieved it.
And when you were in that process of trying to do and putting together Young Skins, did you ever have a moment that you thought that your stories, forget about the fame and recognition, but that your stories would be so widely read?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly didn't think that, you know. I hoped for it, but I couldn't. I didn't think so. I mean, so many books are published these days, especially first books, whether they're novels or short stories, it can be very hard to get a wider readership. I thought I had a chance in Ireland just because the publisher who put it out there, a very small publisher, but were very well established and had a very good track record, you know. And so that was my main confidence booster, that the Stinging Fly Press were putting out the book. So I knew it couldn't have sucked that badly if they were putting it out. You know, and I knew that they would take the time to ensure it got, you know, publicized insofar as they could do it. So in Ireland, I had a sort of, you know, a reasonable expectation that people would at least take a look at it purely on the, even if they'd never heard of me or completely unfamiliar with my work, that they would pick it up on the merits of, because of the reputation of the publisher. But beyond that, Cindy, I had no conception of any. I was like, why would anyone from like London or New York or wherever want to read this book about a bunch of, you know, Egypts in this small town in Ireland? So it's been a great, tremendous surprise to me, you know, the whole way along, really.
So as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversations, several of the stops that you've made on your tour have been to talk with creative writing students. Is there any message that you feel is particularly important for them to hear, or advice that you tend to offer as far as becoming a writer and getting your work done and out there?
Yeah, I mean, what I try and tell them, Cindy, you know, and I can only, of course, go off my own experience, was, I mean, I did a creative writing course, but when I think back of the years I spent trying to get published, and within the world of writing, I've been published, you know, very young. I was like 32 when my first book came out, and that's, you know, that's the great thing about writing. You might not get published your first book till you're 50 or 60 or whatever, but that doesn't matter, you know. You know, it's not like playing sports or something where you have to make it by a certain age. So I kind of tell them, you know, I did a master's course, but it was 1 year long, maybe 10, where I was trying to get, you know, where I was aspiring to be a writer. And I had all those other years as well. I try and tell them to take their time and just work on the material, just write and rewrite, get it as good as you can. Don't be afraid of writing badly. Don't be afraid of not quite being sure where you're going with it, you know. Anyone who's wrote is going to be familiar with the sort of uncertainty and the periodic bouts of doubt. And I think I just try and communicate to them that that's okay, that's an integral part of it. And before you write in any way well, you probably have to write badly quite a bit. Certainly I did, and continue to do so. So I try and just get them to maybe take a little bit of pressure off themselves. Because when you're very young, of course, you're very ambitious and you want to get somewhere as quick as you can. You know, and people make a commitment to these courses and they think they have to be published, you know, within 6 months or 12 months of getting out of there. And I say that's not always the best thing for you. Take a few years, take your time with your work. So that's my advice to them, whether or not they're going to listen is another thing. But I just try and make them not put too much pressure on themselves or their writing. You'll get there in time, and it does take time.
Colin, did you say that you were 32 when Young Skins was published?
Yeah.
I don't believe that, because I'm looking at your picture right now, and I was just thinking to myself, I was listening to your voice and thinking, gosh, here is this young, handsome guy in his 20s. He has this amazing voice with accent from Ireland. All the girls in the U.S. he's talking to must be falling madly in love with him. And I don't believe that you're in your 30s.
I am, yeah. I'm 30. I'm 32 at the moment, almost 33, yeah. I look a bit younger for whatever reason. So it's fun going into bars and being constantly ID'd. And that's nice, I suppose. It's a compliment in a way. But yeah, I feel older.
Oh my goodness! And are all the ladies in the U.S. falling in love with you? Are you married?
I'm not married. I have a partner. I have a girlfriend for we've been going out about 7 years now. Lucy, she's a doctor from Dublin. So yeah, I've been having a good time over here. But no declarations of love so far, apart from for the work.
I bet you're breaking hearts. I don't believe that for a second.
I'll see how far the Irish accent gets me over here.
So now I imagine you have the daunting task now of working on a second book, or do you have a second book already done?
It's not done. I'm working on it, yeah. And I suppose it is a daunting task. The second book is a novel, which I'd attempted to write several novels in the past before I kind of wrote Young Skins. So it's sort of for me, it is a return to the form rather than starting out new. But it's a very different thing to writing short stories. It's one long piece you've got to commit to for however long it takes. And it's kind of still in the early stages, actually. So it's slowly taking shape, but it's probably a little bit off yet before it'll be out.
Is the process exciting for you? That process of writing and discovering and figuring out what it is?
Yeah, it's very exciting. I mean, that's the funnest part in many ways. Sort of figuring it out, putting that shape on it. Because once you get past a certain point, either with a story or a novel, and you've kind of established the setting and the characters, and then you've got to kind of finish it well, you know. You've got to set it up. You've got to close it off. But in many ways, the fun part is that early stage of just generating ideas and seeing what paths you're going to follow and what characters you're going to choose to focus on. So I'm kind of still in that stage, and it's full of lovely potential, and it hasn't been ruined yet by being turned into an actual thing, you know. So when things are still in the potential, they still seem so lovely and, you know, wonderful. And so I'm still there with it, but I'm focused on it now steadily and writing away in as much as I can with it every day.
And Colin, we need to wrap things up, but you know, this your book Young Skin seems to have come really at a very ideal time because there is such a renewed interest and popularity in short stories. If someone listening is thinking about going out and reading a short story collection, why might they want to choose yours?
Well, because I wrote it for a start. I would hope that my collection is a pretty decent in sort of, if you hadn't really read short stories before that much or whatever, that it might be an interesting gateway because basically because I've read lots and lots of short stories and have been heavily influenced by a lot of writers. So I've tried my best to take, you know, good parts of their work and put it in there. And I suppose it is short stories that are set in the present, you know, and it is in a small town in Ireland, but I don't think it's the characters are in an unrecognizable situation for readers anywhere. So I think, you know, it would be, I mean, I would hope that it's a book of short stories that above all else will speak to someone, you know, in today's world, and they'll recognize to a degree the sort of plights and situations of the characters.
Colin, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
Jonathan O'Dell's latest novel is Miss Hazel and the Rosa Parks League. It's a thick, juicy book, great cover, but it was a title that immediately caught my attention. As soon as I saw Miss Hazel and the Rosa Parks League, I knew it was a book I wanted to read because, as I explained to Jonathan, I just don't think that we can write too many stories that inform and hopefully inspire about the need for equality in just so many aspects of our lives.
Yeah, especially when we keep refighting the same old battles. We start thinking, oh, we've made these gains, we can take them for granted. And the things I wrote about in the 1950s in this book are being refought. They call different things, different code language, but we're still fighting for the right for the vote, right for equal protection under the law, freedom from police brutality. Even women's rights are coming back around again, where women again have to make the case that they should have control over their bodies and their lives. It's just amazing.
It really just is amazing. So please tell us about this book. What is your novel all about?
The book is about two women. One, Hazel, is a white woman who was born poor but becomes well off. And her relationship with a black woman, her name is Vida, who becomes her maid, but not in every sense of the word. And oftentimes when you hear about maids, their white woman's relationship, you have a subservient role. I wanted a black woman who could stand on her own two feet, who was as willful as the white woman was, who could take the white woman on. So I have both women lose a child. And that was what I was wondering when I was writing this book. What would it take for two women separated by race at a time when they were trained to distrust each other? What would it take for them to have the possibility of being intimate, to having an intimate friendship? Well, not that they could, but what would open up the door? And the only thing I could think of that would be common across the race line would be the loss of a child. And so both women lose a child, and of course they know, like all women in my family who have lost a child, only another mother who's lost a child could understand that loss. So even though they're put at odds with each other in the book, they find common ground in how they are both treated as women. And on that small ground, they build a relationship.
So where did the story idea come from, John?
Well, the Hazel character is based on my mother. One of my influences is Pat Conroy, and I was reading The Prince of Tides back in the 90s.
Oh, amazing, book.
And it hit me, my gosh, he's making a fortune writing about crazy families. I've got one of those. So his mother is very much reminiscent of my mother as far as very narcissistic, but also a full-blown character. So Miss Hazel was my mother. It was an effort to understand who my mother was and why my mother was a 1950s housewife who hated the role that she was given of being a housewife. I don't think she liked being a mother. I don't think she hated cooking. I just knew there was something in her that wanted to get out, but there was no access to that in the 1950s for a woman, especially in the South. So a frustrated woman with the role that she'd been given. And the maid was the maid that we had when I was 5 years old. And she wasn't one of those maids who you read The Help or other books. It's like, oh, she was just like one of the family. We loved her. Like we did that blah, blah, blah Southern rhetoric we give about our maids. Now, the only thing that we had in common was I hated this maid as much as she hated me. So she was a very strong black woman who didn't take anybody's guff. And I said, well, and it hit me, a black friend of mine who learned that I was going to write a book about race said, oh, great, what we need, another white man writing about race. And he said, but if you have to do it, make sure you don't write a book about don't write another To Kill a Mockingbird, which I love that book. I mean, it's a magnificent book. But he was saying that wasn't the point. He says, black people hate that book. And I said, why? He says, because it's the same old storyline. It tells the black folks they need to look for a white man to save them. And I don't want my two little girls, who have very dark skin, to believe that nobody's going to save them except them. You need to create some black women heroes who they can aspire to. And that did it. I said, okay, I want to write a black woman. She doesn't have to be perfect. She is flawed, but she has retained her soul. She may have been victimized, but she is no victim. And I was wondering, so I said, okay, I want to see what happens if I put them in a household where they are stuck with having to deal with each other. So that's where the idea came from. And also, my parents lived through Jim Crow and earlier than that, and I was just always curious as a kid, also living up Jim Crow, is how in the world did I become racist? I mean, nobody sat down with me and said, okay, John, you need to look down on black people. But through the coded language, through the everyday behavior, I became a benevolent racist, which was I didn't hate black people, but I was sure that I was better than they were. And so I wanted to say, how does a five-year-old child who is taken to church every Sunday and learns about Jesus, the Savior, who loves all children, yellow, brown, black, and white, how does it get coded in his own soul that he's superior? So I wanted to write a book that dealt with those subtleties. We think about the South, think about racism, we think about integration, segregation, lynching, freedom marchers, but I wanted to look at the more subtle aspects of racism. How do we raise our children in the most Christian of environments to end up thinking that they are privileged as white folks? So I wanted, so that's where the child came from in the book. I wanted to look very closely at that child and my own history, and honestly about how do you take innocence and turn it into a perverted kind of benevolent racism.
John, do you still see yourself as being racist?
Mm-hmm. I've given up on trying to. I'm also an alcoholic, and I know I've been in recovery for 36 years with my alcoholism, and the only way I can honestly deal with my own racism is just to accept that that goes deep. I was taught to be racist not by the people I hated. It'd be easy if it was, you know, the George Wallaces or the guys in the white sheets who taught me to be racist. It wasn't. It was my mother. It was my neighbors. It was my teacher. It was my preacher. All because they loved me. They were trying to tell me that I was special. So my self-concept was formed with that toxic element. And I still catch myself going into those earlier tapes, especially when I'm afraid, when I'm feeling insecure, I will rely on my whiteness. So I think I'll always be a racist. And what I do is recover day by day. I recover the same way that I recover with my alcoholism. I own that I'm powerless over it, but I am responsible for my behaviors, and that I'm tempted every day in a society, which is not just the South, but America, which holds up the white as the ideal of beauty, of intelligence, of success, and blacks as always as outsiders. So I'm tempted to drink every day of my white supremacy, and no matter where I live in this country. So I just learned to be on guard with that. And also learn to talk. I have make sure I have enough black friends to tell, look, here's my story. And they keep me sober. They will call me on, John, you know what? In fact, before I release a book about racism or about that deals with race or an essay, I have a network of black friends. I say, would you read this and tell me when you see a white man talking? Because I've still got blind spots. And they will say, you know, when you do, it's in fact, with Vida in my book, The Black Woman, I wrote the entire book, the first draft, without her having any kind of sex life. And because I didn't want to deal with it. So I had, that was a dimension of her that, as a black woman, I didn't have words for. So I made her sexless. And I said, you know, a black woman living in those days around black men is going to get flirted with. Why don't you make her fully human? So it's like those little blind spots that I have. I was talking with a friend just the other day. She's a constitutional lawyer at the University of California, Irvine. She had me out to talk to her students on race and law. And I was joking to her about this maid that I actually had. Her name was Alma. And I hated Alma, not because she was black, but because I noticed that when she came to take over the household, my mother would leave to go to her job. And I figured I could get my mother back if I got rid of this woman. So I lied about this woman. I would hide things and told my mother. See, I wasn't so much a racist then. I was just a racist in training. I knew how to use my daddy's prejudices against her without even knowing it was about black and white. I knew that when she left the house, when my mother left the house, my daddy left the house, and Alma came, my daddy was worried about things going missing. So I would hide things and tell my daddy Alma stole them. And I even told my mother that Alma put on and wore her clothes while she left the house, when she left the house. And I didn't remember this until I went and visited Alma 50 years later after my parents fired her, and she told me what I had done. And so she was still mad at me. I was a 60-year-old man. She was an 80-year-old woman now. We hadn't seen each other in 55, and she was still mad at me. So I was telling my friend, the constitutional lawyer, about this, an African-American, who makes me accountable for being a white man. I said, you know, isn't that funny that she's still mad at me? And my friend wasn't laughing. Michelle said, you know, it's not funny. No, at all. It's not funny at all. Do you realize that the word of a white boy, a 5-year-old white boy in those days, could have got a black woman lynched? Do you realize the power that you white people carry around with you? You're like guns. Cocked and don't even take responsibility for the power and the danger that causes to us people. It's kind of like a slap against the face. It's like, oh, that's my white. I don't have to notice those things. And my black friend says, if you want to be a friend with me, you're going to have to start being accountable for the privilege and the power that you wield as a white man, because it does affect me personally. So it's always those learning points. I learned those. I still have those blind, not because I'm an evil person, but because I have an addiction to feeling better than others, to feeling superior, you know.
Well, I certainly don't think that you're the only one, and whether I'm sure there are plenty of people all over the country who didn't grow up in the Jim Crow South who would say that just this whole society that so many of us have been brought up in, it's just that whole idea of prejudice is just, it's like one of those inherent beliefs that you just can't escape from. And I think a lot of people are working consciously toward eradicating those thoughts from their minds, but it's just, it's not easy. It does take, like you said, an effort every day to think about it. It's like, who do I want to be? Who do I want to be today? What type of person?
Exactly. And I need to surround myself with people who are different than I am. And that's where society gets resegregated. We just have people alike who think like we do and don't challenge us in our thinking and our perceptions. And as a psychologist, I mean, I studied, I had a master's degree in psychology. The most important concept I learned is about 5 years old, we see what we believe instead of believing what we see. So we learn a narrative of the people around us, and we learn certain things become invisible to us. We are taught not to see. We are taught a certain blindness. And it takes a lot of work to undo that. And it's a lot of work. Go ahead.
So, I'm sorry. So you've gotten amazing reviews, I think, for Miss Hazel and the Rosa Parks League. Yeah, and including one of your fans is your own beloved Pat Conroy. That must feel pretty good.
It was amazing. Marley, my agent, when we came out with the book, she says, above all people, who would you like me to ask for a blurb for the cover? She was starting to send out the book to authors and papers before it was released so we could put something on the cover. And I said, you know, my secret passion is to have Pat Conroy say that he likes my work because I love him. And she says, I'll call him. I'll send him the book. And he gave me the blurb. And Cindy, I called my mother and I read her what Pat Conroy said. And my mother's a fan too. And she started crying. And I went, oh my gosh. And she says, oh, I'm so proud of you. This is so wonderful. So I called my agent again. And I said, Marley, I said, my mother read Pat Conroy's blurb and just started falling. She says, oh, I've got to call Pat and tell him that. So about 10 minutes later, she called up, and I said, you tell him? She said, yeah. And I said, what did he say? He said, good, I love to make women cry.
No, that's great.
And I have to remember that because I get some flack because I don't write in the minimalist, very intellectual way. I go for the emotions. I mean, I love to make not only women cry, I love to make myself cry. I know that I'm not writing well unless after a couple of chapters I break down and bawl, you know. I write for women, and I write for men who aren't afraid of their feelings. So I like Pat Conroy, I'll swing hard for the emotions. Sometimes I miss and sometimes I get it, but the times I get it are worth it. I love, and that's why I write, is to reconcile emotionally with my past, with myself, with my family, with those. You know, one way I dealt with my race was just to connect, just to disconnect from the South, just to say, okay, I don't want to be one of those people. I don't want to be them. I'll move away to Minnesota. I'll become a Northern liberal. I'll just forget all that. And I think it was Tom Wolfe who said, you can't go home again. But what he didn't say, which is also true, is you can never leave either. You are your home. You take that with you. And I think Martin Luther King said, you know, you can't redeem what you hate. You can only redeem what you love. So the book was my love letter to the South, the flawed South, my flawed family, my flawed self. Not to hate them, but to accept them on the terms of reality. And then and Pat Conroy gave me a way to do that. I think that's what he does with his family, his writings. He tries to redeem what he can from a pretty traumatically abusive childhood.
Yeah, redemption. That's such a powerful thing. Jonathan, we need to wrap things up. But already. You know what? We've been talking for over 20 minutes. And we've been having a fabulous conversation. I've really enjoyed talking to you. But Miss Hazel and the Rosa Parks League, why should someone pick it up?
Because we need to know these stories. The book is written about the 1950s, pre-civil rights, what went into making this movement happen in the 60s. And the truths are being forgotten. First of all, I want to relearn that it was the women, the black women, who started this movement, not white men, not white kids from the North saving black folks. It was the women, the maids, the share workers, the sharecroppers, the illiterate people sometimes who stood out. That's the history. And also that we're in the, if you look at the news today, we're refighting the same issues. Do black folks deserve an equal right at the vote? Do they deserve the equal? In Minnesota, the most liberal of states, we incarcerate a greater percentage of our black male population than any other state. We're still dealing with that. And yet we're blind to it. We think we've overcome. I love it when people say, oh, we're in a post-racial era now because of Barack Obama. We are more racial now than ever, and it's the same old stuff. Voting rights, equal opportunity under law, freedom from police brutality. And it's a woman's book, too, because it's about the woman's fight for to fight the laws that are being still reconsidered to control her body and her choices. So it's pertinent, but the number one reason to read the book is because it's fun. Even though I talk about race and all these heavy stuff, it's a fun book to read. You'll laugh a lot. You'll meet some characters that you want to carry with you after the book is over. So that's my spiel.
I love your spiel. Thank you so much for talking with us, John.
Thank you, Cindy. I enjoyed it very much.
Win a copy of Miss Hazel and the Rosa Parks League by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Thanks to Jonathan, Colin, and Susan for being on tonight's show. And, of course, a big thanks to you for listening. I hope you'll be back next Monday night. And in the meantime, visit our blog at litnewengland.tumblr.com for more book giveaways, for audio author extras, to listen to past episodes of the Literary New England Radio Show, and for so much more. Again, thanks to all who took part in our frighteningly good Witchathon. I had a ball. Until next Monday, I wish you a great week and great reading.